This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking about overcoming failure with Alex Staniforth. He describes himself as an adventurer, athlete, keynote speaker, and is author of a book called Another Peak, which documents his time learning to set new goals for himself when some of the achievements he's long dreamed of don't come true because of things outside of his control. He's someone I was really looking forward to interview, as someone that's really done well at owning failure, that he will talk about it and he'll talk about what he's learned from it. I think so often people like to separate themselves from their setbacks, that it can be like a funny little anecdote 10 years ago, but it can't be something that's a part of who they are. And I think sometimes, particularly when talking about ambitions of yours, you know, big things that you've structured your life around that haven't come true, or you've gone a different route, I think it's really important to acknowledge that that's okay, that you don't have to succeed at everything. And that's not always some issue with your personality or who you are. It can just be the way that things went.
I totally agree. Just the fact that even what failure meant to him, because on the surface of it, pardon the pun, talking about a mountain and snow, on the surface, you think, well, you haven't really failed directly, Alex, because, you know, there's a massive bloody avalanche coming your way. And that it's not exactly anything in your control. But it just goes to show again how words and language are so subjective, and what they mean to us might mean something different to somebody else. Because, you know, it's easy to say, well, it wasn't your fault, you had no control, and all of those things. But those feelings that are still attached to failure, you know, however we want to really, coin the term failure, but are his own. Doesn't matter what anybody else might see as it being a failure to him, or he's not his fault, or you didn't really fail or whatever. To him, it was his own failure. And I think that's really important up front as well to kind of mention.
Yeah, absolutely. That there can be such power in actually associating with not just the good times, but also the bad. And that's something we try and generally advocate on the podcast, that people should feel more comfortable owning the difficult times and the mental illness symptoms, because really that's how you connect with people. If you can explain what you've been through honestly and openly, then people will better understand you. And I've certainly found that even with people in my own personal life that now also listen to the podcast, and then I see them and they've got like all these questions every time I see them, because they're getting to know me just through my openness. And that can be really powerful.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about failure, it's been one that Danielle and I have found a little bit difficult to research, because it's something that's acknowledged so often as a factor in mental health. And we've got endless sources of mental health professionals and researchers talking about this link, but actually finding this quantitative data where there's stats for it and when there's really specific studies drilling into what makes this link work, it's actually been quite difficult. And I think that's the case with a lot of the topics that we cover that are factors in mental health. They can be kind of acknowledged, but the time isn't always made. Maybe the money's not there to research them as much as there is the more purely scientific elements of, okay, let's see what's going on in the brain with a specific condition. And that makes sense, but I think there's got to be a mixture of both, because the science behind it is really great if you're involved in medication or if you're a mental health professional. But for the rest of us out here just trying to do our best to overcome mental illness, it can actually be the sort of the day-to-day stuff, like failure, like we've talked about body confidence, like we did in a recent episode on sex, like things that just come up in life that can be factors. And so often they're the exact ones that we need to take ownership over. The stuff that's coming up in our lives and how to better cope with them, we have to have a lot more ownership over that.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you drill down, like you said, the day-to-day life stuff that we're all out here dealing with, that feeling of failing is often what hides behind.
For sure. And that's one of the reasons why I was so glad to interview Alex on this topic, because actually, to me at least, the things that he's gone on to do where he hasn't gone down the route he was originally planning are actually the stuff that's most interesting. The things he's learned along the way, the experiences of mental illness that have taught him so much, he's actually created a whole new business and life out of. And whilst we can never say which one he might have been more content with, he's certainly doing such incredible work now. And that was partly enabled by the failure. And yeah. I think that's so powerful. And then we did want to share as well, in lieu of some statistics, we've got a bit of information we found where people have described this link between failure and mental health. So first off, from AXA Healthcare, I'm just going to quote part of an article on the feeling of failure that they wrote in 2015. Getting to grips with feelings of failure means recognizing you have them and how much they are affecting you. Being passed over for a promotion at work, not being picked to play on a team, or being left out on a social occasion are some of the potential triggers. Knowing your triggers is important to helping you overcome the problem. Experiencing feelings of failure is often linked to other health issues, including depression and stress. It's not surprising when you look at some of the symptoms common in these conditions: having low self-esteem, feeling hopeless, helpless, lost or alone, and having continuous low moods or sadness. So I thought that was really interesting, as not just suggesting the link, but also actually explaining how much sense the link makes, that there's a lot of the feelings that come up around failure are actually crossing over with symptoms of certain mental illnesses. So depending on the level of intensity, you can see how ongoing feelings of failure could easily develop into certain conditions.
Yeah. It always inspires me. I think, my research mind goes off then, and I think, oh, you know, what is failure? What are we dealing with? And you're right. It's amazing how much it does correlate, that huge crossover between all of those feelings and how much they're attached to it.
So to finish up then, I know, Danielle, you had one more bit of information you wanted to share.
Well, yeah, I just feel obviously his, you know, his journey and his sporting background and the fact that he's done so much for charity. Alex, you know, really is amazing, inspires me. And, you know, I'm an absolute sport fanatic and watching and playing all my life, every sport going. I read an article from the British Journal of Sports Medicine, which kind of summed it up and what's happening really well. And the article read that the psychological response to injury can trigger and or unmask mental health issues, including depression and suicidal ideation, anxiety, disordered eating, and substance abuse or use. And I think that is so important, because his injury, Alex talks about that being such a big setback for him. And then he saw the onset of his eating disorder and some other issues that were unmasked for him. And so I just think, again, it was just really important to get that in, because sport is a big thing for him. Now, without going into it, I won't talk about the episode, because I'll wait for you all to hear everything that he's overcome. Yeah, it's just really, I just thought that was really important.
For sure. And I'm glad you've mentioned that around eating disorders and sport as well, because that's so common. And I think it's kind of understood in the abstract, but still so often when people talk about eating disorders, what comes to mind is teenage girls. And whilst there is huge prevalence in that group, that's far from the only demographic. So I believe you got a stat as well on prevalence.
Yes, I have, from everydayhealth.com. One of their stats was that athletes may be up to 3 times more likely to develop eating disorders than people who don't play sport. And that is really interesting, actually, because what do we align with sport and athletes? Health. Mm-hmm. Healthy eating, nutrition, you know, healthy minds, all of those things. But 3 times more likely to develop an eating disorder are athletes than non-athletes.
It is incredible. And I'm a little bit stuck for what to say on that, because so many of these stats just do surprise me. Like, you can see the links. I understand that certain sports, there is an element of fasting, potentially quite intense weight watching. And that can go both ways. You know, you get it in sports like boxing, where they're weighed in for certain categories. And so then a lot of them are either trying to quickly lose weight or quickly gain weight to be in the right category. And like you say, there's that association that you see athletes and they're really held up as the pinnacle of a like healthy lifestyle because they're training all the time, because they have to watch what they eat. It's not always as simple as that, you know, because athletes include so many sports where you have to watch your weight. Some you may not even think of, sumo wrestlers, the amount they have to eat to be at an appropriate size for their sport, and their weight is partly used as a way to protect them from injury. And yet, by any other definition, that's not an aspirational weight.
Absolutely. But then, you know, there are health condition concerns that come from that. And it was key when it terms it as disordered eating. Because when we think of, oh, an eating disorder, we think of anorexia nervosa and bulimia. But actually, anything that causes you to eat in a way that's unhealthy, there's work that needs to be done a lot more around that to raise awareness. And I think Alex is absolutely doing that as well.
Yeah, no, that's a really good distinction, actually, the difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder. So an eating disorder being the one that's diagnosable, but even though disordered eating isn't considered diagnosable or as severe, it's still an important term because it can be quite harmful for people. And it can be quite normalised. A lot of university students, for example, could be described as having disordered eating because of, let's say they're in Freshers Week and their sleeping pattern's out of whack, so they're maybe not having the usual number of meals, and they may be hungover, so they're leaving big gaps between eating because they feel sick and things like that. That could easily be described as disordered eating. Yeah, and depending how severe that kind of stuff is or how ongoing, then it can become more harmful. Even if it's not an eating disorder, there can still be serious physical health ramifications.
Absolutely. And that's well put, Bobby.
That is just one example I thought of. I've nothing against the student lifestyle, but I do want them to be safe. So I think we will finish up there then. So we'll get into the episode with Alex in a moment. I'm confident, listeners, you'll really love it. He's very sweet. He's very insightful. You won't be at all surprised on hearing him speak that he's done a TED Talk. I think he very much has the insight level for it. So we'll get into that interview in just a moment. But first,
who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Alex Taniforth, and my earliest interaction with mental health was, I think, when I was probably about 8 or 9 years old. I was diagnosed with a mild form of epilepsy, and although it was only a mild form that was soon brought under control, they're pretty terrifying things for a person to go through, and that led to extreme anxiety around certain situations where I had a seizure. So, for example, having one at school, having one in McDonald's, that kind of became a trigger for me, and having panic attacks. And at the time, also, I didn't know what a panic attack was, so it was a pretty terrifying thing to go through, really, especially at your young age, trying to kind of learn to manage these things and prevent them coming when I felt at risk, or I recognised kind of a trigger. And so from a young age, I was kind of a nervous wreck, afraid to be out of my house without my parents for the fear of having more seizures, really. And I guess although the epilepsy was soon brought under control, that was just the catalyst, really, from, I guess, my journey in mental health and in other ways as well. I know my mum had suffered panic attacks, and I remember actually at a young age being in the car with her when she had one. This was before I think I'd had my first seizure, so I think that probably had an imprint on me as well.
Right, for sure. Given that your mum had experiences of panic attacks herself, did she realise straight away when it was happening to you?
I mean, I'm 24 now, and I think that it's hard to remember that far back, but I think she was able to assure me it was just a panic attack and that it was harmless. Even when I thought I was, you know, I was dying, I was having a heart attack, and I became very health conscious because of having to go to hospitals with lots of scans for my epilepsy, and that's made me very, very squeamish today. Even now, that's one thing I'm still kind of, I struggle with, because I felt that the healthier I was, the less at risk I was. I think that's almost why exercise has always been really important to me. But I think at the time, I found school very, very difficult. I mean, having to run out of classes because I was about to have a panic attack, you know, was something I remember quite well. And I think my parents really supported me through that epilepsy process. And I'm very lucky that I've not had a seizure now for 14 years. But I think that at first, yes, she was able to reassure me, but to be honest, I've I've had panic attacks as recently as last year. So it's been something that's always been there. I've just got better at managing.
Right. Okay. And so at the time you'd had a lot of intervention in terms of the epilepsy. At what point did you receive any help mental health wise?
Well, to be honest, I just kind of got on with things really for a long time. And I didn't get any type of professional help around that until I was about 14 or 15. And again, I was having a problem with anxiety at school. And it was something where I'd read an article. I can't remember the gist of it now, but the risks of, I think it was like the risks of sudden death or something. I just got very obsessed and paranoid and just anxious about health, really. And I think that was making me extremely, extremely anxious being in school, where I was out of control or I wasn't in my safe space. And I almost explains how the love of the outdoors came in later life. But I think I remember seeing the school nurse and just having that chat, that reassurance. I think it was the first thing I remember, just trying to almost help me cope with all that I didn't understand at such a young age, because mm-hmm. young people don't. And I didn't get any professional help after that until I was diagnosed with depression for the first time when I was 16. So I was just leaving high school, going to sixth form, and that's where I saw my GP. And then I wasn't actually referred for further help at that point, but I remember going to my GP about it, and that just almost putting a diagnosis there helped me to really accept it and realise this. There was a reason for why I felt like this, really. I've never felt like that before.
Right. And with you going to the GP, was that the symptoms were changing or just they were becoming unlivable?
Yeah, so I think the anxiety was always there. Over time, it became less of an impact on my life. It wasn't bad enough that I couldn't cope with it. But with the depression, that was quite a sudden onset that I'd never known anything like it. It was like being stuck in this bottomless pit, and it was quite crippling, really. You know, and I think that was when, you know, mum said I need to see a doctor, and I've always been quite open to speaking, to asking for help, but it wasn't kind of severe enough to go on medication or take it further. It just kind of passed over the winter. It was just triggered by a very simple event. It was a breakup for the first time, and that was something I'd not dealt with. And I guess at a young age, it knocks you for six. I think what happened is it just dug out some stuff from the past that I'd kind of replaced in other ways, if you know what I mean.
So what do you mean by that? Was there was something else you think connected to the breakup?
Yeah, well, I think what it was with the epilepsy and the anxiety that triggered. I also had a stammer ever since I've been able to speak, and I was relentlessly bullied at school for being different, just because kids are kids, really. But combined, all those things together really shattered my confidence, my self-esteem. I was always a perfectionist, always very self-critical, always very much expecting the best of myself. Because of that, I'm you know, very, very hard on myself as well. And I think that the bullying had done that to me, you know, had given me that mindset that my self-worth was always very, very low, very, very fragile, very much dependent on external factors. And it wasn't until I found the outdoors that I found a way to really create that kind of validation, that feeling good about myself.
Right, because it sounds, the way you describe it there, like as many people do when they're young, you'd put a lot of your self-esteem into that relationship.
Perhaps, yes. I think it's just that sense of loss, something I'd not really felt before. That was a typical life event, but just not something that I'd experienced. And perhaps feeling out of control, you know, for once. I'd found the outdoors, I'd found a vehicle out of everything else, but this was one thing that actually I couldn't control at the time. And that was only brief, but it was still quite a startling experience. But I think having experienced depression once, that's almost set the seed for it to come back. It kind of left the crack there, it opened. At the same time, almost vulnerable of almost putting a label on it straight away, just when I was having a bad time, but knowing the difference between having a rough low point like we all get and actually having a much deeper problem that is a lot harder to kind of get out of.
Yeah, and I think particularly with conditions like depression, where when you're at your worst, you don't feel worth helping, and it can feel like the safest thing is to just do nothing. I think that's why it's so important for that diagnosis, because then it's something you have to solve in a way. It's this thing you need to deal with, rather than me just feeling like these things and that I'd be safer at home and not looking too closely into how I'm feeling.
Yeah. I think I've always been very open and honest with myself, and that I was always happy to have a diagnosis, and equally I don't want to put a label on it, but I think equally it was just the first step towards getting help for me was actually getting a diagnosis and being able to then find a solution, really. I don't think I was ever ashamed of having that at all. In some ways, it was a bit of an answer, a bit of an explanation as to, you know, this is an actual problem. It's not just me having a bad day, you know, and I think that's really important.
Absolutely. And so you're coming to terms with this diagnosis. It's helping you make sense of a lot of how you're feeling. And around this time, you're also getting more and more involved in outdoor sports, right?
Yeah, it's a long story, but I think prior to that, I mean, about 13 or 14 years old, I'd kind of discovered the outdoor sports by chance. It was on a holiday in Turkey. I tried something called paragliding. Quite an extreme leap. I'm not quite sure where the urge came from, but actually that one
moment...
Yeah,
I'm a bit too afraid to try that one yet.
Well, for me, it was a massive leap out of my comfort zone because I'd never been adventurous. You know, I'd been the kid that came last at sports day. I hated sports. But then that moment kind of changed the mindset from like a victim failure mindset to a victory mindset to actually I can achieve and overcome a lot more than I think I can. And I can prove those bullies wrong. And more importantly, prove myself wrong. But I can't deny there was certainly a big element of wanting to prove the bullies wrong. And that was the way out of it for me because the outdoors is where I belonged. It was a way that I had to really fight back and just not be afraid of being different anymore and just feel that buzz, that sense of achievement that overcame everything else. I think almost getting back the time I'd lost from depression and being from anxiety, just not really challenging myself. And that kind of started the seed for wanting to do more and more. So over sort of 2 years, I did quite a lot in terms of trying rock climbing and then doing a lot of mountain biking and started running, hill walking, went to the Alps at 17, which was like my first step towards Everest, and just constantly raising the bar. And that almost took my mind off everything else. And that was my focus, really. And that kind of, that focus was what kind of beat the depression because, you know, I had so much positive stuff going on, really. The problem I then found was that when all that's taken away or isn't available, then you're vulnerable to coming back, which it did, and has done a few times since and developed into a different animal every time, really.
And it's interesting there that you've talked about the depression coming and going. It sounds like when you'd put so much focus into how you can find victories through sport, you then left yourself open to, well, when things don't go well, when I have setbacks in that way, how does that affect my mood? Do you want to share a little bit more about that and in particular one really big life ambition you had?
Absolutely. I think we're all striving for that one big thing in life, especially young people in this world of 24/7 connectivity, where we're seeing the world around us, we're comparing ourselves and we're seeing the things that are out there and the opportunities we have probably more than ever. And I think the problem is if we're all about reaching the top, then we're never quite going to be satisfied because, as I said in my TED last summer last year, 2018, about was needing something bigger than Everest because ultimately, we're never going to be quite happy. We're going to want more and more and more. And then eventually, if we can't reach that, then we just feel hopeless, depressed, and we lose that kind of sense of purpose. And I found that with my journey to one of my ambitions, which was climbing Everest, which kind of was my goal from about 13, 14, when I went hill walking for the first time in the Lake District. And I think 10 years ago now, actually, I remember being in the hills and just having this kind of question pop into my head, this kind of curiosity as to, where is Mount Everest? Didn't know anything about it. But something about it just really captivated me and seemed to be the ultimate thing I could overcome after everything else and just the ultimate achievement to almost prove myself in life. And I just knew at that age, at 14, that one day I was going to climb Everest. I had to. And mental health was actually the catalyst, really, for Everest nearly becoming a reality because I knew one day it was going to happen. I started to research and make the plan as to how I was going to get there, what steps I needed to take. And I got injured from running and cycling after climbing Mont Blanc and carrying the Olympic torch. As I suddenly had all this massive excitement, I had this goal, I had all this focus, and I was buzzing and just loving life and loving the ability to fundraise for charity as well. And then I suddenly lost this outlet, I'd lost my way to kind of achieve things. And that's when I sank back into depression, as I'd known it before, but worse than before. I was self-harming, I was just really struggling. And that's where my eating disorder started because was working as a pot washer in a kitchen, you know, all the glamorous jobs to start with. Makes a far cry to what I do now. And I was also surrounded by food. And I thought, while I can't run, I'm going to focus on my nutrition just to make myself a better athlete when I come back. I didn't know when Everest was going to happen at this point. And naturally, this all or nothing perfectionist mindset that I had, this self-critic, expected very, very high standards. And obviously, when I couldn't match this kind of bohemian regime of, you know, cutting out all these kind of bad foods that I'd read about, that's when the binge eating started. And then it was bulimia. And then suddenly I built this horrible coping mechanism that 6 years later, I'm still battling. And that, for me, was in that really hopeless place when I may never train properly again. I needed a goal. I needed something to get me out of it. And that was when I kind of decided, you know, 2014, I'm going to attempt Everest, as you do. And
can we just pause there? Because it's interesting, the contrast. You've mentioned control in relation to the goals you'd set yourself and your achievements through sport. And it reminded me of how often people talk about control relating to eating disorders.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there was some element of you either finding control in one or the other?
Absolutely. And I find that I struggle most with eating now and food when things aren't in control, when I feel like I'm not in control of where I'm going and achieving a purpose. And so I have to find that with food, either by, you know, binge eating and kind of a bulimic behavior, you know, or kind of going, you know, the opposite side and cutting back on food, you know, restricting, which as an athlete obviously has implications because I'm just burning so much fuel.
Yeah, and one thing that many people don't understand is that your body just isn't set up to lose that amount of nutrition so suddenly. And so it's not just that we may be slimmer and we may quickly lose weight, but you can also be losing muscle and other things that are integral to you performing through sport.
Yeah, and I think I've found that I had a bit of a turning point actually quite recently based on that. I think the control thing is absolutely key, you know, and it's our human need. We need or want to feel in control. And I think it's being comfortable when we're uncomfortable, I think is really key. And I've built that anyway through outdoor sports and through endurance challenges. But this is where we challenge the whole mental toughness mindset, because, you know, despite having the resilience to deal with the outdoor challenges, mental health and eating disorder is a completely different beast. And I think for a long time, my frustration with it was that if I can do all this other stuff, if I can overcome all that, why can't I overcome this? But it's a different situation.
And it sounds a little bit like that's something you'd struggled with from a really early age, because you were experiencing the panic attacks and the epilepsy that were completely outside of your control.
Yeah.
So even once you were getting those more managed, you're still, in a way, maybe overcompensating?
I think I was, yeah. And I think the eating disorder was a way of overcompensating because I couldn't burn the calories from exercise anymore. I'd always enjoyed quite a relaxed relationship with food. I always had a really good appetite, always loved sweet things and eating a lot. Stuck in this whole belief that, oh, I'm an athlete, I can eat anything I want, which doesn't quite work that way. But ultimately, yeah, it's trying to compensate for something. There was something missing in my life, you know, and that's why ever since then, it kind of, I've had periods when I've been in control and I've not had really, the eating disorder hasn't been a problem. Become more serious in probably the last year, actually, due to a variety of things. But I think ultimately it was just peaks and troughs, and that was what affected it.
Mm-hmm. And before I interrupted you, you were going to tell us a bit about what happened when you went to attempt Everest.
Well, I left the suspense. And I guess that ambition for me was ultimately a way of getting control. You know, it's just only I can let myself down. I'm not being limited by anything else. But that was kind of what the excitement of it. But the problem is, you realise through that is that so much in life is out of our control. And when we have the setbacks, for me, I get a massive kick about overcoming adversity. You know, this massive sense of, I'm not being defeated. You know, to hell with that. I'm going to get back up again. And that is all about adversity. It's about how we respond to it. You know, we can't always control what happens to us. We just control what we do, how we get back on our feet. And that, for me, is the biggest driver in life. But ultimately, you know, life has other plans for us. And I think until we've experienced that, when things don't go to plan, you know, whether that's climbing Everest or whether that's trying to study a degree or follow a certain path in life, you know, we can sometimes have that sidelined. And if we don't know how to cope, as I've seen around me, that's a massive trigger for many people. struggling with their mental health is because the plan falls apart and they haven't built that resilience yet to cope with that. The first year in 2014, I got there as planned. I'd raised the money from corporate sponsorship. I was 18, so quite young. And the expedition was cancelled the day before we got to base camp because of a big avalanche, which tragically killed 16 people. So we, well, had no choice but to go back home. Went home and kind of, you know, tried to process this. And that's when you realise that actually we can't be afraid of failure, because sometimes no matter how hard you work, it can be completely out of our hands. We just have to use it as fuel to win, you know, a chance to learn and come back stronger. Which is easier said than done. That's what we did. And then went back the following year. And this time we were on the mountain when the Nepal earthquake hit. So we were hit by an avalanche in the Khumbu Icefall. Luckily only a powder avalanche, so we were pretty much unharmed. Whereas base camp was wiped out. And sadly, we lost three of our team out at base camp that we'd left that morning. And we were trapped on the mountain for 2 days. And that was obviously the end of that expedition. So that's as far as I've got with Everest. And naturally, having been through such a traumatic experience as that, I mean, again, I was very lucky to be coming home. That is obviously going to cause a lot of mental grief. And naturally, I had to cope with my, you know, with eating again and kind of a depression, but now a bit of a survivor's guilt. That winter was probably the worst depression I had. It kind of kept coming back every winter, I think, because it first happened in winter. It almost seemed to know every winter it seemed to come back as a bit of a cycle.
Right. And also you mentioned survivor's guilt. If someone's not aware of that term, could you just share what that was like for you?
When people have died in something that I was in, it's almost that sense of why them, why not me? And the natural response for me was to throw myself into something positive, which is fundraising for Nepal, which I did. But yeah, it's just really difficult emotion to deal with. And it was my friend Rich who actually really helped me through that, because he'd been in the army, he'd experienced much, much worse at a young age. And he sort of said, you have to grow from it, otherwise it'll grow on you. And those words really stuck with me. And so I grew from it, you know, and it's the only way we can, but I think...
Yeah, I love that, because ultimately there's no way to rationalise that, whether it's a natural disaster like that or whether it's losing a friend if you work in the army.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's about kind of gratitude. At the same time, it was a really positive thing that happened to me, which sounds bizarre to say, but it gives you gratitude for what's important, you know, not to stress and worry about things that don't really matter, you know, the bus being late or something. I think that... It's that sense of gratitude that I'm grateful to have at a young age, because I mean, I was only 19. The problem with that is also there's this pressure to make the most of my life and to do as much as I can and always trying to match up to this, perhaps this unreachable level of achievement in life, because people on the team haven't come back and I have, and I've got to make the most of mine, you know, and that's the difficulty I've got, is just finding peace with myself, really. But giving something back, giving to charity, has been the best way to do that.
Yeah, exactly, because it'll never be right that those people died and that you can't fix, but it sounds like you found a really healthy way of coping with it by thinking, okay, well, that's a negative. I can't fix that, but I can put more positive into the world.
Yeah, because we have to give more than we take, and we just have to create something from something negative. And that was the only way I could process it, really. I'm fine with it now, but I often find myself, when I'm in these low troughs, you know, thinking, if I'm not serving a purpose, what's the point of me being here, really? Which is not perhaps the most helpful mindset to have, but this is why for me it's really important that I'm always trying to challenge myself and do more, and but equally allow myself to be human and you know, just be who I am as well, and then slowly making progress on that.
I get that. I can be quite similar, and I certainly find that experiencing depression myself, that a way that I've coped with it a lot of the time has been through my work and through productivity. And no work has been more closely linked than running a mental health podcast.
Absolutely.
And so that can really help quash my feelings of self-doubt or uselessness when I'm feeling at my worst, that I know even if my mental health is bad right now, the podcast is out there and people are listening to it right now.
Mm.
And so there's something productive I'm doing, even if my own mental health is having a bad day. And that's really helped on one hand. But then on the other hand, whatever work it is I'm doing, I still have to take days off. And that's the harder bit, that I've got better at like forgiving myself ultimately for needing time off for illness, but I've still not reached a point where I can just take time to do nothing and not feel the need to have an excuse for it. And that's kind of my next milestone.
Okay, interesting. I think this is the challenge with people that are suffering with their mental health, but also producing something to help others with theirs. And I've almost found this when it comes to writing, you know, writing a book and when I'm speaking about mental health, is that sometimes, you know, I can be, people can see me on stage speaking to, you know, maybe 100, 200 people about it and not realize that inside I'm feeling absolutely rubbish. And it's important that we don't compromise our own mental health in the process of doing that. But for me, I've experienced that same feeling where if somebody's benefiting from me being out there and doing it, that gives me that sense of meaning, that sense of, yeah, I'm serving a purpose, so it's okay, you know, but I'm trying to get better at looking after myself so that I'm able to help others as well. And that's key, I think.
Yeah, and that's a really great point, that it's a fine line between you helping others also being good for your like self-esteem and your feelings of self-worth and productivity, but then that should never negate you actually doing the work on yourself.
Sure.
And that is something that I see at times that concerns me with people working in mental health, that they can put so much focus on the work and looking after everyone else that they then suffer as a result, that they're not paying attention to them.
That very much defeats the object. I think it almost gives power to the problem. I think it's finding that balance of just accepting ourselves and looking after our own mental health. And I think it's just really important that we're true to ourselves. We tell people how it is. You know, we're having a bad day. We shouldn't feel bad about putting ourselves first. And I think the best quote I've heard on that is that, you know, it's why they tell us to put our own oxygen masks on first on the planes, because we can't help other people without that resilience to look after our own resources. And I do worry that I've seen more and more mental health advocates and campaigners, which is fantastic to have you talking about that, but almost, are they going to be able to get away from their problem? They almost need to be able to separate themselves from their challenges rather than it becoming their identity, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I structured this show in the way that I did, that we cover all kinds of mental illnesses and also general factors in mental health, because that way it's not every episode that I have personal experience in. I find I can relate to every guest, but it's actually really helpful to have that variety.
Sure.
I think if I had a podcast that was all about one condition that I experience,
yeah, and every
it would be quite full on.
Yeah, and every condition, everyone's challenges are very individual, as you know, and I think when you look back at them, it's hard to really remember just how acute they can feel. But we can't be unjust to ourselves and actually what we've been through and actually saying, yes, that's how bad I was. But just because they're not as bad now doesn't mean they weren't bad. And I think that I just want to be able to help people by just being human, saying, you know, I struggle with this. This is what I've dealt with and this is how I've got through it. And maybe this can help you. That's kind of where I want to sit, really, kind of to decide and just say, okay, well, let's talk about it, but let's also, you know, let's do something about it. You know, let's make some changes.
Right. I really love that. I love your commitment to honesty, because I think the alternative can actually be quite self-stigmatizing, that there is a lot of pressure when you speak openly about your mental health to create this sugar-coated narrative that like things were bad and now I'm better and everything's fine. And actually it's a lot more gray areas than that. And by succumbing to that pressure to be like, oh no, I'm fixed now.
Yeah.
Which I don't quite believe in that idea of someone being fixed or broken.
It's an ongoing journey.
By if you do give in to that, then it can be really self-stigmatizing, because then it's harder to ask for help because you're meant to be the role model.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And does that mean you're then a failure if you relapse?
I mean, I've almost had the same battle myself, not so much mental health, but as a venturer and as an athlete, this is what almost stopped me talking about my eating disorder for so long, because I wore this badge of, you know, you're supposed to be mentally tough, you're supposed to be this. And you know, people see me speak on stage and have no idea that I could have literally been, you know, binge eating or purging literally hours before, and I can just get on stage and switch to a different person and they'd have no idea.
But it only tells half the story then. You know, it's all well and good telling people about the physical struggles,
yeah,
but actually any type of extreme sport like that, anybody I think that would go up Everest would tell you how much the mental strain.
Oh yeah, I mean, people
is very much a challenge.
Sure, people often say that climbing Everest is 90% mental, 10% physical. And I'm very open now about my mental health struggles as well as the actual challenges of being on a mountain and also my other outdoor challenges I've done. Because you can learn a lot about both put together, you know, and I think they definitely complement each other. The outdoors makes you so much more resilient, and that's really helped me just to not be affected by the daily trivialities and stresses. But equally, it's that wearing that banner of, you know, of an athlete and adventurer, we think people expect better of us, almost, and that can obviously become very, very unhelpful. But at the same time, also gives us a good platform to show that mental illness isn't a barrier to achievement. You know, people can appear as if they're functioning entirely normally, yet having all these things going on in the background. You know, as we hear in so many influential figures talking about their mental health struggles, to name but a few, you know, you've got Stephen Fry, Prince Harry, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Olympic, you know, Olympic athletes, footballers, hearing more and more and more. I think, as you said, it's key that we just show the full journey. And I think for me, it's just about telling the journey as it is, peaks and troughs, highs and lows. And that's what I think we can all relate to.
Yeah, I love that. We're just going to wrap up shortly. We are running out of time, but I wanted to finish up by talking about that big life goal of reaching the summit of Everest. So this question is kind of two parts. A, what was it that clicked for you that you didn't just keep going and reattempting the same thing? And then B, could you share a little bit more about the kind of the next challenge you took on in lieu of it?
So basically, after that second attempt, I hadn't given up on Everest. You know, I wasn't afraid of what happened. I just accepted that this is just the fragility of life. And really, the biggest risk is taking no risk, because, you know, so much of the certainty around us, we just have to go out there. And I think in some ways it encouraged me to do even more, you know. But after I'd kind of cope with it, for me, writing my first book, Icefall, about the experience was very therapeutic. I think putting it down on paper, fundraising kept me very busy. And then I started preparing for a third expedition, but this was to go to Choa Yu, which is the sixth highest peak in the world in Tibet. I think that was towards put to bed the experience. But that winter, I threw myself into running and training. And even, I think that was the first time even that didn't cut it. And that was when I started on antidepressants for the first time, just because it was getting like worse than it ever been. Even speaking to schools was just, it was raw. I couldn't, because it was so emotionally raw, my stammer came back and I just kept really messing up talks, and I very nearly gave up my entire speaking career. And fortunately I didn't. And that summer, having that focus of that expedition really helped. I started eating disorder therapy because I went to my GP for the first time, obviously for, you know, the antidepressants as well. And that really changed the whole situation with depression. And again, it was, I think naturally the outdoors became a better medication. Therapy didn't really work for me, but I kind of discharged myself because the expedition, the outdoors, had again almost fixed me faster by the time it took to actually get the appointment. And so I went to that peak, and this time there's no disasters. We got to 7,200 meters, got to the summit push, and that's when I came down with altitude sickness, which basically meant that I had to go back down. You know, if you go up with that, you can die. And I was very nearly evacuated. I was in a bad way. But that trip, I had a bit of a light bulb moment. I realized that actually, in a tent, on my own, well, obviously on a team, but otherwise on my own, halfway across the world, could I be doing something close to home? You know, what's this all about? Because I'm only going to get to the top, and I'm never going to really going to get there. I was inspired by a British girl called Elise Downing, who actually did the foreword for my next book, who was running around the coast of the UK. And it seems to be an amazing way to really explore our home country, get people involved. People were coming and joining, like the Pied Piper, achieving something in the process. And it just seemed a fantastic way to do it. So that inspired another challenge close to home. And 2017, 2 years ago, I started Climbing UK, which again was trying to do something that hadn't been done before, human powered. So I was climbing to the highest point of all 100 UK counties, running, cycling, walking, kayaking, 5,000 miles in 72 days. And that was fundraising for Young Minds, which, you know, as you can see on my jumper.
You're still branded, still, even now.
Still branded, yeah. And that for me was the major turning point in my life, because this challenge was just down to me and my ability really to carry on going. I mean, obviously there's, things could have happened, but there's no avalanches, there's no Sherpa strikes, there's no, you know, the weather. I mean, apart from the British summer, it was just back to basics, and people had the chance to actually get involved, and actually it raised £25,000 for Young Minds, which is 2.5 times more than my target. And it was just an amazing way to really experience the UK and just kind of create that conversation around mental health. And that was when I actually announced my eating disorder for the first time, because I had to give people a reason to support, you know, to donate. And actually it was terrifying, but I'd spoken openly about depression, fine, but there's something about the eating disorder as a man that just, it felt so awkward. But I did it, and inspired by another athlete, reading his story made me realize, crikey, this is empowering, you know. And that 3 years ago, you know, was quite a terrifying thing, but completing that challenge was the first time I'd really ever actually not failed and actually achieved something that I set my mind to. And I realized that that was probably as good as Everest would have been. You know, Everest wouldn't have really given me anything more, and I would have always been looking for that next thing. So climbing the UK was 2 years ago, but I'm still, you know, almost riding the wave now in some ways. And it's time for a new challenge, but that was what came next, and that inspired my second book, Another Peak, which came out in July 2019, early this year. And that tells that story, but more openly about mental health and the benefits of the outdoors and adventure and what we can take from that.
That's really lovely to hear. That it sounds like that was the first time you'd brought all your experiences of mental illness right to the heart of what you were doing. And it was climbs you were doing in the UK, where you're from. It just seems like that one was the one that was more honestly you than ever before. And perhaps that's part of what drove you, because it's far from an easy challenge.
No.
72 days of such solid.
Yeah, it was physically and mentally tougher than anything I'd done. It was that day-to-day endurance and that kind of dealing with the factors and, you know, injury and chest infections and just mishaps and delays and constantly racing against time. It was exhausting. But yeah, it felt genuine. It felt right. It felt what adventure should be about. And it was just that moment on the final peak was just phenomenal. I think the story behind the book, though, is that there is always another peak, which is also what the book's called. And that always, I get a sense of when we can't see the top, you know, when we're in these troughs, there is always another summit. There's always more light ahead. Just to try and create hope, you know, and also just to get other men talking about their mental health. I think in athletes, especially, there's a real link between eating disorders and this whole culture of kind of calories, and you've got to run X far to burn a mince pie at Christmas, and all this kind of culture we're seeing, and I think how dangerous that is.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is rationalised because of the sport.
Yeah.
That you're allowed to be as extreme in your eating and your dieting because of the sport.
Yeah, and there's a lot of myths around that, and I think that as time went on, I mean, I've been speaking kind of become my career as a result of failing Everest, really, because it's given me a kind of a unique story. I started to speak more openly about mental health. I kind of just kept dropping a little bit more and more bits and posting more bits online. I think online social media was a much easier way to do that without that kind of awkwardness we might fear. And the book puts it all out there. Things that are in the book that even my family didn't know. I never felt comfortable telling them. And I'd broken down in tears to my GP about over years earlier. But what I found, and I know that Tom, the athlete who wrote in The Guardian when I read about his story, was that there was only a positive response to it, and other people were then opening up too. And like, people were then messaging me saying, I suffered with this as well, but obviously I had no idea what other people were dealing with. And they were surprised, but nothing but a positive response and respect from, you know, for me. And then one standout story is a friend who was an international athlete posted a blog about her struggles, you know, of an eating disorder, something I obviously hadn't known about. And I messaged her saying, you know, well done on speaking out. And she says, it was your blog that gave me the courage to do it.
Wow.
And it goes to show that's one story becomes another story and makes these things easier to talk about. And she'd already had several friends of her friends messaging her saying, I've suffered with that, but I've never had anyone to talk to. I've never known who to talk to about it. And that for me was like, that is why I do what I do now. I talk about mental health. I write about it. And was able to kind of overcome that fear. And now, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I've just come speaking at a mental health conference for an institute, mental health in the workplace, you know, talking about my story there in front of 150 strangers. And obviously that's worked out well to come here and share my story now on a podcast with many more people. And that's all I would say to anybody is, you know, don't be afraid of sharing your story, because you can change your life.
Brilliant. So we'll wrap up there. That's a really great place to finish. One other thing I wanted to put a pin in is what you mentioned there about an overarching theme of the book being yeah. that there's always that next challenge, that next peak. And that mentality, I think, is incredibly helpful when it comes to failure. Yeah. Because actually, there's always going to be a new challenge, whether you succeed or fail with the current one.
Yeah.
And can be incredibly helpful when you're struggling to take that step back to be able to see objectively there will be another day, there'll be another thing yeah. that you can succeed on.
And the book really is kind of a self-help book in disguise. It's not just another adventure book. Yeah, it does talk about the days of cycling in the rain and, you know, and all that and the physical peaks and the troughs. But it is that sense and that there's always a solution no matter what's going wrong. Failure really is just down to our response. You know, success is about how we get back up again. But it is that sense of hope. And I think our generation coming through is the first in the history of mankind that are more likely to harm themselves than another person, which I think is terrifying. A lot of them are struggling because they're struggling to find their purpose, their meaning in life, and they're expected to do all these things. And there's a sense of burnout and all these new pressures. I think it's like, how do we create that hope? I think the problem is it's difficult to experience it until you've been there. And that's why I think the first time you suffer depression, you suffer any mental illness, it is terrifying because you don't think you're going to escape. You know, you don't think you're going to see the view from the top. But it's learning those ways to kind of keep going up the hill and know that the view from the top is worth the climb. And I think through my speaking, through the book, that's kind of what I try to do. And I just hope it's enough to get people, you know, to kind of keep on going, really. People have been saying to me, what's next? What's your next challenge? My Everest this year has been to build that foundation to look after myself physically and mentally. And so, you know, I'm so grateful to be able to run to have the health back. And I realised that how miserable my eating disorder was making me in control of my life. And it's sort of showing that there are always better things to aim for and better things ahead.
For sure. Brilliant. And you are making such a difference. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been great talking to you.
No, it's been great to be here. You know, thank you for having me on. Thank you for all your work and time to share these stories and get those out there. I think it's, you know, it's fantastic work that you're doing, and I look forward to seeing it grow and grow.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.